I want you to take this land, make it, my brothers, shake it, squeeze it, turn it, twist it, beat it, kick it, kiss it, whip it, stomp it, dig it, plow it, seed it, reap it, rent it, buy it, sell it, own it, build it, multiply it, and pass it on. You hear me? Do you hear me? Pass it on. Thank you.
Oprah Winfrey reading the words of Toni Morrison. You can watch the full Toni Morrison remembrance at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Stay tuned. It's time for Sojourner's Truth.
Join KBOO by December 31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the KBOO app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
By some hole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we kick off a six-part series, Conversations in Southern Illinois, highlighting conversations with residents, including farmers and environmentalists in rural Southern Illinois, home to Shawnee National Forest. It is part of a new Sojourner Truth occasional series, Bridging the Rural-Urban Divide in the United States. The Shawnee National Forest, which consists of about 280,000 acres of federally managed lands, is the single largest publicly owned body of land in the state of Illinois. There are seven officially designated wilderness areas lying within Shawnee National Forest. In the 1990s, early environmentalists with Earth First joined local Southern Illinois residents and took direct action to stop logging in Shawnee National Forest. Their actions resulted in a 17-year moratorium on logging in the forest, saving thousands of trees and greatly benefiting the surrounding community. That struggle was also an inspiration to the newly growing environmental movement. But now, that moratorium on logging has been lifted and logging restarted. In the past few years, grassroots environmental protection groups have formed to protect these lands. Today, residents are again mobilizing to protect the environment in the region, groups including Friends of Bell Smith Springs, Shawnee Natural Area Guardians, a Southern Illinois Against Fracturing Our Environment, and Shawnee Forest Defense have come together to challenge most recent threats to the Shawnee National Forest and to other parts of Southern Illinois. In October 2019, the Shawnee Forest Defense, the Global Justice Ecology Project, the Indigenous Environmental Network, and others co-sponsored the Resurgence 2019 North American Forest and Climate Movement Convergence at the Forest. The Sojourner Truth team covered that event. After the convergence, I returned to the area to meet with local residents, including environmentalists. Today, you will hear an informal discussion with seven Southern Illinois residents. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now, you will hear our discussion with seven farmers and environmentalists based in Southern Illinois, including Deborah Booten, Renee Cook, Dennis Connolly, Karen Fraley, Georgianne Hartzog, Clint Heise, Sam Stearns, and John Wallace.
Really delighted to be back here in Southern Illinois, but I wanted to get a sense of, from your point of view, what are some of the challenges in terms of the environment that you feel you are facing now? Right now, I mean, I want to go back and have a little bit of the historic struggle, but just in terms of what you feel is happening now. And that could be anything. It could be impacts you've seen of climate change. It could be changes you're seeing on the land if you're involved in growing food. It could be the threat to Shawnee, you know, to the national forest. It could be some of the impacts of the mining industry, you know, that has happened here, contamination. So it's a range of things. And I'll leave that to you. Right. And who wants to start on that one?
We were just talking about the lack of tadpoles in our horse's trough. And not seeing
and
snakes.
This is Dennis.
Yes,
speaking.
I'm Dennis. Mm-hmm. And not seeing snakes, you know, and I'm concerned about whether it's the UV rays or what. But, you know, it's unusual not to see tadpoles and snakes. There's been times when you could see four different species in one day, and now you're lucky to see a snake once a week. You know, so there's something going on there, you know.
Well, and it's relevant because we live quite rural in the Driftless area in the hills of Southern Illinois. The thing that I've noticed that I think concerns me greatly is the impact of industrial agriculture. And I would just say, in terms of this tadpole business, when I first moved where I am, which is 6 miles off of the highway,
This is Georgianne.
Yeah. I moved out here, out there about 28 years ago, and you could not drive home on a spring or summer day that you didn't feel as if you had murdered at least 100 little baby frogs hopping across the road.
Wow.
You could not take a walk down the gravel road or whatever without having to brush the butterflies aside in the middle of summer.
Wow.
You know, and I personally think it could be Roundup because there's not huge numbers of agricultural fields around me, but enough that I know it's been used heavily and people just use it. And the other thing is we have orchards and there's just heavy chemical use in the orchards. So besides all of the other things, you know, habitat loss, I think chemicals must have something to do with it.
The thing that, this is Deborah.
I've been hearing so much the last 6 months about what the scientists call the worldwide extinction of insects. And that's terrifying to me. And I feed the birds in my front yard. And so over the 16 years that I've been in this particular spot, I've noticed a dramatic decrease in the number of birds that show up at the feeders. And I put suet out for them all winter long, so they've got fat. And I used to have to put a suet cake out at least once a day. Sometimes they would go through them in half a day. Nowadays, I can have a suet out there for 4 or 5, 6 days, and it's still there. It's like, where did they all go? You know, so that this thing with the insects, you know, I have a very tiny piece of property right in the middle of town, and I try to do what I can to control, like, the fleas in my yard because I have dogs, so I use nematodes. I used to use, like, Dawn dish soap and things like that to kill off the larvae, the flea larvae that was in the ground. But I've stopped doing any kind of that because you know, I want them to have a little haven. You know, I walk near this in the city cemetery in Carbondale where I live, and last spring I noticed like all these fabulous wildflowers are coming up, and the little insects are all over the place. And then I go back a week later and the maintenance team has come by and weed whacked all of the wildflowers. So it's like, I didn't see any insects for the rest of the summer. You know, it's like, and as I'm saying that, here's an insect flying around the light fixture up there. It's like, there's one left.
We are a holistic home.
Yes.
Right. Anyone else in terms of any changes that you have seen?
Oh,
of you have been here for some time, right?
So this is Karen, and I've only lived at this place 2 years, so it's hard for me to say how things have changed here or not. But someone, I think George Ann.
The area before?
Yeah, an hour from here, an hour west. But I'm convinced that the Roundup and the genetically engineered crops, the Roundup Ready crops and things, have truly affected the biota, for lack of a better word. So I'm interested in butterflies, and I have taken classes and traveled across the state for workshops on butterflies and moths and dragonflies. And I've been taken by biologists to a place to see like a butterfly called a towhee skipper. It doesn't exist there anymore. It's not been seen in Illinois since I saw it maybe 10 years ago. Yeah. I was taken to another place nearby there to see a type of butterfly called a regal fritillary, I think. And the field was thick with them. It was as thick with those of any butterfly I've ever seen. They say now they aren't there anymore. They don't see them. And the only thing that I can think that has changed, of course, the temperatures have changed and stuff, but something about the chemicals that are used on the crops and in the yards and the chemicals that are in the crops so that they have a resistance. It has changed things, the engineered crops.
Because they've also been growing the BT corn around here.
Yeah.
And
right. Yes. And that has changed, I believe, a lot of the, you know, I see it in butterflies because they are big and charismatic. But that goes all the way to bees and all the insects. And we do. We take insects for granted. And
you
it's,
know, I'd say bees, bumblebees, all the kind of native bees, too, are used to be so much heavier presence at my farm than they are now.
And part of that is, this is Karen again, and I think part of that is from the spray and the, but also because they of the farming techniques, there aren't the weeds that had the flowers that they fed on.
Right, the loss of habitat. Right.
Yeah, so it's the whole lot circle of life. Whether
there
it's
were quail along the road that I drove home on when I first moved out there, 8 or 9 years into living there, no more quail. There actually were a few quail in one patch of ground we let grow into mostly goldenrod and stuff like that, and a friend came along and mowed it, and no more quail. But there were actually quail along the road.
Wow.
From Pomona up to my house when I first moved out there.
What about others of you? I mean, I know, Clint, you've been where you are for 40-something years.
Yes.
And you must have seen some changes happening during that time.
All those people were speaking of, the bees are not near as prevalent. The bats have gone. The quail that used to be around 45 years ago aren't there. And there's a lot of factors, but really what scares me most is the poverty in southern Illinois, because that's going to affect the environment in ways that we don't foresee. The people would be glad to have a job, even in industries like coal mining, but those aren't there. So when you've got extreme poverty, you're going to be dealing with things like meth, and that's a big problem here in southern Illinois. Well, that affects the environment, all the toxic chemicals involved in the meth production. So that scares me as much as the chemicals, just the poverty that we see here.
you know, the chemicals that are being made and taken by people.
Right.
Well, and the other kinds of things. Thank you so much for bringing that up, because that is definitely something I've noticed, you know, and the kinds of things people will have to do to survive, you know. I mean, whether it's cutting down the trees that they might own, their family might own, to make some money, or, you know, living in the most... you know, what would not be comfortable situations for most of us, old trailers and, you know, the kind of, the many kinds of, you know, eating, not eating any kind of fresh foods, not having access to fresh foods, all the kinds of things that go along with poverty. And because we're so rural, you know, we often don't see it.
What about Sam?
This is Sam, and this conversation is really disturbing and distressing to me, because I started noticing on our property, where we have been for over 30 years, about 10 years ago, I started noticing that the hatching out of insects and the birds, well, the blooming of plants and the subsequent hatching of insects that are on those plants, and then the birds that feed on those insects, those things about 10 years ago started seeming a little bit out of sync to me. And for 10 years, they've just gotten, that's become more and more extreme. And there's a particular bush on my property. I have a half a dozen sweet spire bushes. And when they bloom out years ago, whenever the sweet spire bloomed, the insects were so loud on those bushes that I could hear them from the opposite side of my house. I mean, I could hear them from 40 yards away buzzing. And then when I'd look at them closely, there might be as many as more than 10 different kinds of little tiny wasps and pollinators. And I don't know what they were, but little insects that were doing all this buzzing. And for the last 10 years or so, as I have watched that change, like this year, for example, when those sweet spire bushes bloomed, there was not a single insect on them. But the reason this conversation is so disturbing to me is that I kept thinking that was just localized, that it was some, maybe perhaps a natural cycle that things were going through, and that, yeah, the insects have disappeared for a while, but they'll be coming back. And I figured that the other people around this table who live 20 miles, 40 miles, 60 miles away from me, I figured, well, just because I don't have those insects on my property, they've probably got them over on their property. And they're, again, there will be a natural cycle. It'll play itself out. And my property will be rich again in insects and birds and bats. But now hearing that this is so widespread just in our region, I realize that it's more of the bigger global problem that I'm hearing about. And I don't know what the mechanism is. I don't know if it's just harmful chemicals in agriculture, or one of the things I most often think of is that our upper atmosphere has changed so much that is having a detrimental effect on the insects. Or more likely, it's just a cumulative effect, a combination of all those factors. But whenever I hear stories about extinction, you know, worldwide extinction, I just kept thinking that was in the Amazon and in other places where that was happening. And I didn't realize that it's happening to my neighbors here in Southern Illinois, just like it's happening at my house.
Absolutely. And what do you think, John?
Yes, this is John. It's interesting to just hear everyone talk about these individual occurrences that happen, and I think how tied in they all are. We live in this complicated web of life that we rely on so many other different life forms, and the nature relies on so many other different life forms. And when certain things happen to the natural world that take out components of the natural world, the web starts unraveling. And, you know, this, as Deb mentioned, the insect Armageddon is wow. truly, it is happening. I can't begin to tell you how often in the spring, you know, you would drive on in a low area, you know, a floodplain area or what, you know, on a road, your windshield would just right. get covered with mm-hmm. with insects. You know, just you'd have to use your wipers to be able to see because there's so many insects. Mm. You don't see that anymore.
No,
but Dennis mentioned the tadpoles are missing. Well, guess what the tadpoles eat?
Right.
You know, the butterflies are missing. The birds, yeah, it's all tied in together. Mm-hmm. And the genetically modified organisms is so frightening because it's happening out in nature. We are doing these things that humans have never done before. We're manipulating our biome, and there are things taking place. The Roundup Ready corn and soybeans. You know, it's not. When I was a kid, soybean fields weren't perfect.
Right.
You know, there were weeds.
When I was a kid, your job, this is Karen.
I grew up in a really rural farm town, and to make money in the summer, you would go out to the fields, and the farmers would pay you to, they called it walking the beans. You'd walk the bean fields, and you'd cut the weeds by hand.
Yeah.
And that was how they cleaned them up. Well, they don't do that anymore. They spray chemicals on them. Yeah.
And more because it's the crops are Roundup tolerant, which is, you know, they can apply excessive amounts of Roundup, and even though the weeds are more tolerant, the crops, it doesn't bother them, and all of that then affects the pollinators. They have to have, you know, we're seeing, you know, these crashes of monarchs. It wasn't 20-25 years ago. It was real common to in September, warm days in September, it was almost as if flocks of monarchs were passing over.
Yeah.
And now I feel really fortunate if I see two or three, you know, in a day.
Yeah.
And
of course, the other thing that's happening with Roundup is that the weeds are learning to be tolerant to it, and so now they've added additional chemicals. Is it dicamba that is right. so injurious because right. it can, you know, it can be sprayed, but then it also volatilizes and causes more damage. And I do know that there's somebody around here who's noticed a kill off of oak trees because they're so their leaves are just coming out when that stuff is getting sprayed, and so it's damaging the.
In fact, George Ann, this is Karen. We were just, John and I were at a Shawnee Audubon board meeting last night, and I was setting up the schedule for next year's meetings. And there's a guy who has an organization who talks about the dicamba, the pesticide damage on our trees, and how to identify it, and then how to report it to the Department of Agriculture, because if no one reports it, there's no record of it, and so they say there's no problem. And just like anything, and so I'll let you guys know, but unless people have enough knowledge to identify it and report it, there's no record, and if there's no record, there's no problem.
Right. We're talking a lot about very minute, mm-hmm. this is Deb, insects and things like that, but you know, I for years now have walked out in the woods of the Shawnee with my dogs, you know, gone for long walks in the woods. And maybe 8 or 10 years ago, I ran into a hunter out in the woods down by Renee's house, south of Murfreesboro. And he was, I asked him what he was hunting. He had a little beagle dog with him. He said he was hunting rabbits. And I'm like, well, how's that going? Well, now, rabbits are mammals like we are. He goes, you know, it used to be that I could go out every day and get a rabbit or two for dinner. And now I'm lucky if I get a rabbit a week. Mm. And he also talked about how he grew up in the forest, and how when he was young, he would see migrations of squirrels, where there would be hundreds of squirrels running through the treetops.
Wow.
Because they would eat all the nuts in a certain area, and then they would all migrate to a different area because there's a lot of oak and hickory around here that have the nuts and everything. He's like, I haven't seen a migration in years. So it's not just the tiny little insects, which the insecticides and everything, the chemicals make sense, but why are the mammals disappearing? You know, rabbits eat grass and weeds. Like, you know, what's
so
up with that?
So there's likely a relationship with that. Did you want to add anything to this particular section, Renee?
Two anecdotes I have. I've lived at my place on Jungle Road in rural Murfreesboro for 20 years. Shortly after I moved in there, I was on the phone one day with somebody that, you know, some call, some business call. And the woman, I was out on the back porch of my house, and the woman said, "Where are you? Are you in a zoo or something?" There were so many birds squawking and carrying on in the background. I said, "No, I'm just standing on my porch in the woods." The other day, I remembered that, and I just happened to step out. Not, it was this fall, and I stepped out and didn't hear a bird. And I just burst out crying. It was just the death knell or the lack of, I don't know. And the other one, other anecdote, is that on Jungle Road, there's no farming around there. And there was no farming other than a couple cattle, small cattle farmers right up the road from me. About 4 years ago, this guy buys up this piece of property, puts in a big pole barn, big tractors, and a big pond. I thought, uh-oh. And he started farming soybeans there. And I drive by there every day. And one night, a couple of years ago, I was coming back from an environmental meeting. And I realized that there was no bugs anywhere on my windshield or my car. And it was just the coincidence of this guy's farm right there and right here by the creek. And, you know, it was just like, it was pretty clear to me what was going on. And the other thing with what Sam was saying, I think the animals and the creatures are out of sync with the false environment that's being created by geoengineering. I'm just going to go out there and say it. It's geoengineering is happening, and they are changing the atmosphere, and the whole entire atmosphere of our planet has been changed, and it's changing the cycles of the seasons and everything. And so the butterflies are here, but the plants aren't open yet. And so when they're ready to feed, there's nothing for them to eat, and so they die. And so you've just cut that life cycle just right there. And well, maybe, you know,
I mean, certainly climate change is very accurately been called climate chaos, and we can very well see that here in Southern Illinois, where, you know, we were talking about making maple syrup earlier. So when I moved out there 28 years ago, we started making maple syrup that first year. We've gotten to the point now where the weather is so variable, and we know these cold fronts come in, the wobble in the jet stream and these Arctic airs, but also this incredible warming that happens in the middle of winter. And so the poor trees, the sap flows, and then the sap doesn't flow, and the sap flows. So it's not reliable to make maple syrup anymore. You never quite know when to tap the tree and, you know, when you're going to start getting nutrients in that sap instead of nice, clean sap. But, you know, that's one example I have of, you know, how crazy it is. And I remember when I was a little kid in Southern Illinois, the summer was hot and humid as if I still lived in Louisiana, which I did when I was a little kid. And
We have spells in the summer here now when it's just gorgeous. I call it Wisconsin weather or Montana weather, you know. The humidity goes down and the nights cool off and the days are not bad, hot. You know, it's gotten very variable, I'd say, in the last 15 years, much more variable. The other thing, concerning thing I think about Southern Illinois is, and I don't understand it all, but we are a cancer. We have a lot of cancer in Southern Illinois. And why? In this beautiful paradise, you know, we have cement factories that burn toxic chemicals. We have nuclear material being produced on the other side of the river, you know, plus all the chemicals, all the farming that's gone on. I don't know what it all is involved, but it's concerning.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a quick station break. When we return, we'll continue our Conversations in Southern Illinois series.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:29 a.m. Now back to more Sojourner's Truth.
Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. Check us out on our website on sotrueradio.org. If you're on Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook and our handle on Twitter and Instagram at sotrueradio. We're also on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we're going to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Southern Illinois and internationally. A shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the island nation of Barbados. Now we return to our Conversations in Southern Illinois series.
The interrelationship then between the chemical use, the genetically engineered, you know, plants, and they're even now talking about trees, you know, to also the fact that and the global warming generally, just the climate change and the changes in the atmosphere all being interrelated to create this. For those of us who live in the cities, spend time in the cities, I mean, this is very interesting for our audience to hear because you know about the impact in the cities. Like if you live within 1,000 feet of a freeway, which I do, and that likely your lungs are going to be damaged, which mine are, right? And, you know, a lot of the children, their experience of where food comes from is the supermarket. You know, I have no idea of, you know. So this kind of conversation, I mean, talking with people who live in rural areas about the impacts as they are happening, because this is the food that then ends up in the supermarkets that people eat. But one of the things that I've noticed here, I mean, just in, you know, the day or so that I've been here, in the soybean fields, because when we drive by soybean fields, you often see a lot of deer in there. And it's like, why are there so many deer in the soybean fields, right? Well, they're in there eating the soybeans. Now, if those soybeans are genetically engineered or if they're sprayed or whatever, and you have all these hunters that are coming in and hunting the deer and eating, you know what I mean? That whole cycle. Also, on my way here today to meet with you all, there was this beautiful, just this incredible field of birds. I mean, it was like a sea of them, but they were in a soybean field, right? So that's the other thing, like what impact is that gonna have? So we're really getting to the heart of the matter, because what you all are describing is really where not a lot of it starts, because it starts with the producers, Bayer, Monsanto, that on our show I cover quite a bit, and I think they're totally evil, right? But also just the impacts that you all are seeing with the butterflies, the insects, the frogs, the tadpoles may not necessarily be things we're thinking about, you know, in the middle of Los Angeles, for example.
But you just mentioned, Margaret, the birds, and I would guess, Clint, that was blackbirds that you saw in the field.
Yeah, they were black.
And in the fall and winter, they flock up into these used to be giant flocks. You still see them a little bit. But when we were young, in the rural areas, because they would gather up to feed in the fields and things, you would see flocks that would blacken the sky. If you were driving down the highway.
So I just saw a mini version.
Yeah, they have disappeared.
Wow.
It's talked about in circles. It has disappeared. You used to be able to drive, and you might see them. If you were driving down the highway, you would see them crossing the highway for 10 minutes in these beautiful flocks that undulate and move together like schools of fish. Mm-hmm. And now, when you see them for 2 minutes, it's a thrill. The numbers have plummeted of red-winged blackbirds and the blackbird flocks. Have you noticed that, Clint?
Right. Oh, yeah.
It's astounding. And that's something that, unless you're in an area where you would see those, you wouldn't know. And it's
like me, I'm seeing all these birds. Yeah. Well, it's literally about maybe a minute and a half.
Yeah, and you used to be
birds,
able...
Right?
Yes.
And when was the last time anybody saw a similar flock of geese? Southern Illinois, I mean, one of the attractions of Southern Illinois is hunting, and so goose hunting was a big thing down here. And the geese just don't, I mean, I don't know, there's probably not as many of them either, but they don't come this far south. Very, very few of them.
Well, they don't need to. A lot of it had to do with with the frozen water up north and with climate change, they don't have to come. Why fly as far? You know, there's plenty of cropland in central Illinois.
Right.
But something else that's recently come out. There was a study, ornithological study, that is just wrapped up. Cornell was involved. A number of different institutions were involved and researchers, but they evaluated all of the. There are bird counts throughout North America that have occurred since the 50s or 60s, and a lot of them are sponsored by the Audubon Society, and volunteers go out and collect data, and these researchers took all that data and realized that we've lost in North America since 1970, we've lost almost 30% of our avian, our bird biota has disappeared. I believe it's something like 3 billion birds are gone. And then researchers are also looking at climate change, and they suspect we're going to lose another probably 30% due to climate change, and you know, in the future, here, you know, the bats. I mean, bats used to be everywhere when I was a kid. Streetlights, it would just right. Bats would just circle around the streetlights.
Yeah.
You know,
you'd have
lucky.
To wear a hat out in the yard at night because the bats would swoop down and grab your hair.
We used to throw rocks up. And just watch the bats chase. Well, they'd never. No, we wouldn't throw them at the bats. They'd chase it, thinking it was an insect. You know, we got a thrill out of it. You know, their sonar would. You know, but you know, it's a thrill now to see a bat.
Amen. And yet, it's not just the loss of the bat population. It's the pyramiding effect that the loss of these, the avian population, the bats. Since the bats have gone, I've now got a mosquito problem. You know, since another bird population is down, you've got other insect problems. Those insects affect your crop production. You know, it's that cascading effect that you have to worry about. So we really can't tell what we're looking at short-term effects. So what's the long-term effects? That's what's scary.
Yeah, and I mean, listening to all of this, I mean, looking at the region I'm from, for example, I mean, my island is a Barbados. It's a coral island. And it's not a mountaintop like a lot of, you know, the other islands in the chain. So we're flat, a coral flat island. So imagine the impact of just a small rise in the sea level for us. but also imagine also what happened with in the Bahamas. If we had a Category 5 sit over our island for 41 hours with winds gusting up to over 200 miles an hour in some instances, I mean, we would just be gone. And already with Hurricane Maria, we had the island, the entire island of Barbuda, had to be evacuated, everybody off of Barbuda, and were taken in by other islands. When Dominica was also hit, another island in the Caribbean, Dominica, even though it didn't hit Barbados or some of the other islands, Dominica is very much a breadbasket for a lot of the other islands, right? Because, well, a whole set of things, a whole set of reasons. So when their crops are destroyed, then that has an impact on all of the other islands. And then that has an impact with what you were raising in relation to poverty. I mean, maybe not as it's impacted here in terms of meth, but just in terms of the difficulties of people trying to survive, having lost everything, and then having speculators come in from the United States or Canada with the money to say, well, you're in this situation, you've lost everything. This may be some family that has some seaside property or some piece of land that looks like maybe, you know, we could do something with it. So they're not people who are committed to that place and who live to that place, but figure, well, we could make a whole lot of money rebuilding it. So give us your property papers and we'll give you, you know, some little settlement. So what has happened in places like Antigua and Dominica and some of these other places is that the population that has lived there winds up losing land, losing practically everything, you know, with other people coming in. You know what I mean? And that's part of, like, the plan to rebuild a place like Barbuda. A lot of those people who lived in Barbuda before, they're not going to be able to return. It was like New Orleans. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people who evacuated from New Orleans still have not come back, right? So the interrelationship with what I hear you describing here in Southern Illinois and the impacts that we're feeling, like in the Caribbean region, where we feel like we could just be wiped out entirely, is indeed very frightening. So I think the thing next about that, from where you sit here in Southern Illinois, are what are some of the ways you are finding that, because everywhere people are facing problems, you have to assume that there are some people who are resisting in some way or trying to do something differently to help to heal the land or whatever, right? There are people who are doing that. And then what are some of the things that you are up against, right? Who are some of the forces that you are up against? You're trying to protect the forest. I understand that they may be starting logging again in Shawnee.
And mining.
And mining as well. And a number of us remember, because you did get some national coverage for the major resistance that happened to protect and stop the logging, you know, in Shawnee. So, and what you all have just described is really the interrelationship of all things, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Right? And therefore the impact of it. So when that logging starts, I mean, that's just another aspect of it. So what do you see are some of the ways that you are trying to do something about this, that people are trying to resist this, and what are some of the forces you're finding that are standing in the way of that? You know what I mean?
I'd like to, yeah, I've got something to say about that.
Okay. This is Deb. You know, after 30 plus years in the environmental movement, you know, we've seen the enemy and it's us. It's like it's human beings that are selling out the rainforest so they can have their own little plot of land here and willingly, you know, burning, slashing and burning the rainforest. And it's, we're all got here in gasoline engines today, you know. Maybe some of you are driving electric. Thank you so much. And I would if I could afford to. But I really think we're the biggest enemy to this because we like our modern life and we don't really want to give up what we've got. We want everybody else to give up what we want the corporations to give up, you know, their profits and everything. But they only have profits because we're putting our money across the table. So I used to work on a farm with a young man who was from Puerto Rico. And he described to me at one time how he had just been to visit his family in Puerto Rico. And he talked about how they owned this land that had been in the family for generations. And there are orange trees and lemon trees and avocado trees right there on their property. And the fruit was all rotting on the trees and on the ground. And they were going to the grocery store and buying their orange juice. Like, that's not a corporation forcing you into something. Why not go out to the backyard and pick your own damn oranges and lemons and avocados? So something has, you know, I'm going to play a devil's advocate here. We like to blame, you know, the big picture and the big monsters and the big machines, which they certainly have influenced us. But, you know, I'm sorry, but a whole lot of us rests on our shoulders.
What do others think about it? What are some of the ways people are resisting, and what is standing in the way?
This is Sam, and the people at this table are old enough to remember the things we've been talking about the abundance of insects and the abundance of birds and tadpoles and other components of our environment around here. But it's frightening to me to think that now there are generations of people who are growing up thinking this is the norm, mm-hmm. who are growing up thinking that having no insects around is, well, they don't have that memory that we have of the relative plenty of so many natural components of the environment that we used to have. So we have an incentive to fight to retain what we used to have. But now there are people growing up who never had that, so what would their incentive be to try to fight for that and restore that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first... the first action that we generally take to make some change is public education. But it's hard to... there's no substitute for actually having personal experience with the things we've been talking about. There are people growing up for whom big flocks of birds and schools of fish are just an abstract idea. And so I don't know how we are going to convince younger folks that we need to restore what we used to have.
The strangest phenomenon has occurred recently, and it's called this boomer thing. Okay, boomer, or it's just okay, boomer. And it's like, and that really speaks to what you're talking about, I think. It's like, not only is there an ignorance, but there's an arrogance to the knowledge that we all have that just that we took for granted. I'll be the first one to say, and I've tried, but I've also taken many things for granted. And now to have this generational thing coming again, and that concerns me because we really need to stand together, all ages. We need to stand together as human beings on this planet to save our lives. We are in the fight of our lives, and younger people just aren't getting it. Some are, but many, many, many are not. And then they're buying into this. Once again, I believe it's a manufactured division, the divide and conquer premise that, you know, keep them apart, fighting amongst themselves, they're not going to look to where the real problem is. So I think that's a real big issue. And somehow bridging that gap is probably our biggest battle.
Well, let me say this, and I wonder what your reaction would be to it. Two things. Getting back, Deb, to what you raised about the young man in Puerto Rico. You know, I pretty much am in the Caribbean region a couple of times a year. Either, you know, I go to Haiti quite a bit because there's a major uprising going on there, but also going to Barbados. I was in Grenada also last year. And honestly, I don't know. I have not seen what this young man described to you. Because it's true that people, when I was growing up in my village, I mean, everybody had a kitchen garden and grew our ground provisions. And a lot of times you couldn't afford anything else anyway. So that's kind of how you ate. Or you went down to the sea when the fishing boats came in and you got the fish. You didn't eat a lot of meat because you couldn't afford it. If somebody in the village killed a cow, they would announce it like the week before and everybody would put in their little order. Or if somebody killed a pig, you know what I mean? But that was like a special occasion, and most of the time you'd eat chicken when one got run over in the road. And then people had to figure out, well, whose chicken was it? And then most of the time it was chicken soup, you know, once you were able to identify it. But people are growing their food less. And there's also a shift with how people in the region are cooking. And when you talk to people about that, they say, look, we just don't have the time. Mm-hmm. The mother and the father, everybody's out going to work. You know, you're tired at the end of the day. You're picking up some, I can't even remember the name of the fast food, the chicken place, which is a big, it's ridiculous that I can't think of it right now. But it's kind of like the Barbados version of KFC, you know what I mean? It's like a lot of fast food, and even the way my mother cooked or my grandmother or even my sister cooked, I can't cook like they have. I was the youngest one there, right? So there's a culture around food that is being lost in food preparation and also the growing of food because the priorities have shifted. And the priorities have shifted because families are finding that everybody, practically, the moment you're of working age, you could go out and you could bring in a little money, that is the priority. It is not learning how to cook the food. It's not learning how to grow the food. And then that impacts people's health because then people are getting all kinds of illnesses and stuff that they didn't used to get. And a lot of that has to do with now the junk food that people are eating. You know what I mean? So there's an interrelationship mm-hmm. between all of these things that I think brings us back to the issue, not back, but the interrelationship of things like poverty, things like what's happening with the environment. And so that's one point I wanted to make on that. On the okay boomer thing, that's definitely true. There's a lot of ageism about, and we talk about this sometimes on the show. But we're also at a time that the largest and global environmental movement that we have seen are children who are 9 and 10 and 15 years old, etc., across the world. Mm. Across the world, less so in the United States, but if you get the global news, I don't know how, because I also think there's a media desert going on, because I'm really shocked at the limited access to media and what's happening in other parts of it. But it's a massive movement in Holland, in Australia, in New Zealand, in the UK, where you have thousands of children. I've seen them speak, articulate beyond belief. I saw a 9-year-old black kid, he was mixed race, black kid who lives in the Florida Everglades. And he was on CNN or one of these, sitting very relaxed, and he was telling him what for. Like, this is my future, okay? And you all have failed. I mean, as all of what you've done, you have failed us, but this is our life. We are fighting for our lives right now. So on the one hand, there's the okay boomer thing going on. But on the other side of that, there's a massive movement going on that isn't perfect. It's trying to find its feet, you know, and their kids. So there's a lot that they, you know what I mean? And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this, because the other side of it, and then we were having the conversation with Renee, is that the Earth First people and the people who sat in as Shawnee and some of you around this table, you were some of the people who made the way for this massive movement, whether they know it or not. And I don't know if people know that, if you know what you have done. And despite all the differences and the problems, etc., the impact that you have had. And I just happen to think that it's important.
We are out of time. I'd like to thank all of today's guests and the entire Sojourner Truth team. Romero Funes, our assistant producer, and today's audio engineer. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I also want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland's Folk Festival on Friday, January 10th and Saturday, January 11th, 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom in Portland. Portland's Folk Festival is an all-ages celebration of folk and Americana music in Portland. Friday performers include Anna Tivolt, Cedar Teeth, Glitter Fox, and more. Saturday performers include Horse Feathers, The Get Ahead, and more. Again, that's Portland's Folk Festival, Friday, January 10th, and Saturday, January 11th, from 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
When we meet, there won't be winter.
One of the great challenges in helping local folks who are homeless, they may be camping out, living in a car, sleeping on a friend's couch, or some other transient arrangement, is to make regular contact with them. In episode 3 of Local Folks Podcast, Helping the Homeless, Alita, the president of the Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center, talks about how they reach out to the homeless to provide needed services. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
KBOO Community Radio is included in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. Support KBOO in Give Guide today and help us highlight the impact community radio has throughout the Willamette Valley. You also get Chinook book discounts and free items in your email inbox immediately following your gift, along with your donation receipt. The Give Guide is an easy, secure way to make a gift to KBOO. Every gift is appreciated, and the Give Guide processes amounts starting at $10 online through an easy-to-use, secure platform. Go to kboo.fm/give for more information and to donate to your community radio station. Thank you! This New Year's Eve, TriMet has you covered with free rides starting at 8 p.m. and late-night max service until 3 a.m. No surge pricing here. Just a free ride to ring in the new year and a safe way to get back home. Learn more at trimet.org/newyears.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, broadcasting here at 90.7 and streaming everywhere at kboo.fm. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Today's Old Mole Variety Hour looks at issues related to the climate emergency and climate justice, and that covers just about everything, including energy, labor, housing, and gender. On today's show, Bill Resnick talks with Marie-Rose Turek of the Utility Justice Campaign of Oakland, California, about claiming local control of energy, taking it away from Pacific Gas and Electric, you know, the folks responsible for all those fires. Joe Clement introduces words from labor activist Barbara Mattaloni about how to organize and win. Desiree Helliger shares some field recording from the December 21st Portland Homeless Persons Memorial Day Vigil and the life and death stakes about the life and death stakes in the upcoming city council vote on a $22.5 million five-year contract to sweep the city's houseless encampments. And finally, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, The Left and the Law, discuss some of 2019's high-profile sexual harassment cases against powerful men. And they comment on Bombshell, the feature film based on the story of sexual harassment at Fox News. Our shows are archived on the KBOO website. You can find the posts of weekly shows and individual segments a day or two after broadcast by going to our page at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. While you're there, you can subscribe to our show, and we invite you to friend or follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com if you have questions, comments, or suggestions. We turn first today to Bill Resnick's conversation with environmental justice activist Marie-Rose Turek, coordinator of the Utility Justice Campaign at the local Clean Energy Alliance.
Marie-Rose Turek, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Wonderful to be on your show.
Marie-Rose Turek is the coordinator of the Utility Justice Campaign based in Oakland, California. Its mission is to mobilize a broad coalition of climate justice groups, also social justice advocates, ratepayers, and in fact, all the allies they can find. They're seeking a public accountable takeover of the investor-owned monopoly utility PG&E, which is a very different company, has no relation to PGE in the Portland area, except both are pretty predatory. PG&E has been caught. PG&E is now in bankruptcy for its negligence and mismanagement, yet still it's brazenly seeking a bailout that would shift the cost of the wildfires it caused and gas line explosions that it caused for negligence. Wants to shift those costs